Hey everyone, Matthew Petty here, your host for Florida Matters. Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to take a quick moment to talk about how this podcast is made possible. Florida Matters is all about bringing you in-depth stories and important conversations about the Sunshine State. Independent journalism like this takes time, resources, and most importantly, the support of listeners like you. And that's why I'm asking you specifically, are you a listener 40 years old or younger? We're excited to get younger audiences engaged with public media and see you join the conversation of supporting important journalism with a donation. Your contribution of $10, $15, or even $25 goes a long way in helping us continue to bring you high-quality journalism that matters. And here's some sweet news to incentivize you. Thanks to Candy Olson, a generous supporter of local journalism, she'll be adding an extra $50 to every donation made by listeners 40 and under. That's right, donate and Candy Olson throws in another 50 bucks. So head over to wusf.org/match to make your contribution today. Thank you for your continued support. Now let's get on with the show. This is Florida Matters. I'm Matthew Petty. For the past couple years, public school teachers in Florida have navigated some challenging and at times confusing changes to what they teach and how they teach it. Legislation was rolled out with restrictions on classroom instruction on race, gender identity, and sexual orientation. Transgender students have faced restrictions on what bathrooms they're allowed access to. And there's been increased scrutiny and in some cases removal of books on teachers' shelves and in school libraries. And that's added to the other challenges facing teachers, like pay and workload, as school districts struggle to fill staff shortages. One of the most controversial new laws, the Parental Rights in Education Law, or as critics call it, Don't Say Gay, has been clarified after a lawsuit was settled. So we're checking in with some teachers in the Greater Tampa Bay region to see what this means for them and what they're hearing from students in their classrooms. We spoke via Zoom. Joining us, WSF's Kerry Sheridan, who covers K-12 education and has been reporting on how teachers are dealing with the flurry of new laws over the last couple of years. Kerry, thank you so much for being here.
Hi, Matthew. Thanks for having me.
Gail Foreman teaches social studies, U.S. history, and AICE psychology at Booker High School in Sarasota. Gail, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And Brant Robinson, who teaches history at Dunedin High School. Brant, thank you.
Thank you for this wonderful opportunity. It's my pleasure.
Well, Kerry, can you start us off? Just remind us about the new rules that have been introduced since 2022. How have they changed what can and what can't be taught at schools?
A big one last year was the Florida State Board of Education approving new standards for teaching Black history. These standards were for grades K through 12, and teachers had to convey that when under enslavement, some African Americans gained skills that later benefited them. Another one was called HB 1069, which the Governor Ron DeSantis said he described it as it protects students from having to declare their pronouns in school and expanded on the parental rights in education law from the prior year. And what it did was it prohibited classroom instruction on sexual orientation and gender identity in pre-K through eighth grade. So that expanded the scope of that law. It also made it easier to challenge any book that was pornographic or depicted sex or was age inappropriate. There were also laws the state issued to comply with a 2022 law on curriculum transparency, which was called HB 1467. And that training said any collection of books in the school had to be vetted by a media specialist, even those inside teachers' classrooms. And to comply with that law and those rules, a lot of districts across the state just closed down their classroom libraries altogether.
Now, the Parental Rights in Education Law, and critics have labeled that Don't Say Gay. Of course, there's been a lot of pushback from folks who supported that law on that labeling, but that was challenged in court. And a recent settlement clarifies how the law can be applied. Just how big a deal is this settlement?
I think it's a big deal because one of the main issues with a lot of this legislation was the fact that the wording was so vague. Teachers did not know how to carry it out, what to do, how to say what they were supposed to say or not supposed to say. It's just so vague. So now this settlement shows that teachers can respond to students who want to discuss their families or if they have a gay identity that they want to describe or want to write about any LGBTQ topics, they can do that. Teachers can also make reference to LGBTQ plus people in literature, history. Debates can talk about this. Student-to-student speech and classroom debates can all mention these issues. And students can be protected by anti-bullying efforts if they're gay or lesbian, bisexual, transgender, all of those things. So it also it just kind of really clarifies a lot of the confusion around it. And I hope that it's made it feel safer in schools for a lot of these kids.
Well, Gail, I think this is a time to bring you into this conversation. Now, the wording of that parental rights and education law created, as Kerry was saying, quite a bit of frustration, confusion for teachers. I think you were one of the teachers she spoke to when that law was first rolled out. So how did that change the way you teach and what you can and can't say in class?
Well, the first thing was that they came in and they took anything that remotely looked rainbow out of my room, told me I had to take it down. And I did comply, and my kids were like, wait, I thought this was our room, Ms. Foreman. Why are they taking it down? So I had to explain to them what was going on, and I tried to be as politically correct as I possibly could. But my kids were smart, and they knew what was going on. The kids and I kind of muddled through it. We had to cover up our books. Our district policy was if it hadn't been vetted, the kids can't see them or read them. And being a history teacher and being the Gay Straight Alliance sponsor, that was kind of difficult for me because a lot of the kids would come and talk to me and, you know, like it affected the kids because they didn't feel safe anymore. It made the kids question whether they should continue their education.
So have you had a chance to take a good look at the settlement? And I wonder what difference you think it'll make for you going forward and your students.
Our district has not given us complete direction as to what to do. There's a beginning steps, so to speak. Books still have to be closed. I can't say anything, but the kids can. So if the kids want to talk about somebody in history being gay, or if the kids want to talk about a gay issue, kids can talk about all they want. I can't bring it up. If I hear information that is wrong, I usually clear my throat and the kids know that means you need to check this. We're still, the other gay teachers in the building with me, we're still walking on eggshells because you can tell me one thing, but a principal can interpret it completely different as a superintendent can completely interpret it differently. I think there's still some subjectivity to this. Expressions are used that perhaps may be multiply interpreted different ways. And why can't we just go back to being decent human beings to each other and just live and let live? I don't get it.
I want to come back to the books because, Gail, you've talked about, you know, what that looks like in your classroom. And Kerry, you've been talking to teachers about, you know, the impact of these new regulations and restrictions on books and book challenges. Let's hear from Melissa Hall, who teaches career tech at Lutz K through 8.
I'm not sure for people who don't work in education if they understand what the logistics of that look like. We had to scan every book in our classroom. And by every book, I mean every book. So if I have a introduction to computer programming that's mine, and it's on my shelf in the back, I have to scan that, even if no students are going to still use it.
All right, so that's Melissa Hall. And let's hear also from Tracy Overdorf, who is a STEM and math middle school teacher at a public charter school in Hillsborough County.
No one came to take the books out of my classroom. It was voluntary for me. I just locked them. They were behind a cabinet. So I just kind of put them, they weren't really gone. I just locked them up behind a cabinet so they weren't accessible. It was just, I knew that I hadn't had the time to just double check the list. And I know a lot of the list is about fiction books. It's about, you know, novels and things. And I just, honestly, I didn't have time. You know, as a teacher, you don't have time to go through to figure out, you know, oh, are my resource books, are my nonfiction, you know, informational science books going to be allowed in this classroom because I'm too busy doing everything else. I'm grading, I'm doing duty, I'm doing tutoring.
And Tracy went on to say, like, list off a long list of tasks that she has to deal with as a teacher in the course of her regular school day. So teachers are pretty busy. Kerry, I mean, what's the takeaway from what you've heard about the impact of these new rules and restrictions around books for teachers?
Yeah, Matthew, I went back and spoke with a few teachers that you just heard, Tracy and Melissa, two of them that I interviewed a couple of years ago before all this happened. And I was really surprised to hear them say, maybe I shouldn't have been surprised because, of course, I knew about the law and I knew what was happening, but surprised to hear them say that even today, these classroom libraries are gone. They don't have them. They don't have collections of books available to students in the classroom. And these are, you know, books that teachers collect over the years. They could be biology books, reference books, things that kids could look at when they're done with their assignment. Just bolstering the classroom environment, those are widely gone. And I don't think that was the intent of this law.
Hmm. Brant, if I could bring you into this conversation, what does your bookshelf look like now compared to a couple of years ago?
I would first say that most of these laws were done as much to intimidate teachers as they were to pacify a base of supporters. Now, as far as the book situation, I think Kerry really alluded to it. You know, these laws were deliberately vaguely written. And you see that depending on the demographics of the district you're in, the composition of your school board, many school districts completely reacted very, very differently than Pinellas County. You know, Duval County, they just went ahead and removed all the books. Thankfully, here in Pinellas County, we've taken a case-by-case approach, and all the books that have been challenged have all been returned to the shelves, which is ironic because there has always been a mechanism by which parents, guardians, and citizens can challenge books. That's always been the case. So in some ways, we're returning to what was the norm before all this ever happened.
What about the curriculum when it comes to teaching U.S. history, which is your subject area, Brant? Have you had to modify sort of what you've been teaching? Have you had to sort of think more carefully about the kinds of things that you are putting in front of your students in the course of a class?
You know, earlier this year in my African American history class, a one semester course, you know, I teach racial slavery. I teach plantation slavery, which began in the colonial period and continued for another 80 years in the US. Now, when I was done, I showed my students the standard. I put up the standard and I asked my students to talk about it because I've never once told my students what to think. And I would never do that. It's not my job as a teacher. And Gail's very proud of the fact that she doesn't have to do that in her classroom. It's not what we do as teachers. But I just put the standard up and I asked my kids, what do you think about this idea that somehow, you know, enslaved human beings might have developed skills that could be beneficial? And I wish a lot of adults out there listening could have been in my classroom. They've been so proud of my students because, of course, they wanted to know, well, who would put this standard in the first place? You know, and I'm just being very partial about the law itself and the change in the curriculum standards. But, you know, I showed my students. And now that we're deep into the era of Jim Crow, and like today, I taught about the Wilmington Race Massacre and coup in 1898. Next week, I'm going to teach about Rosewood and Ocoee, which are also, as those are state standards that teachers in U.S. history, they have to teach. When I'm done with that, I'm going to put up the standard about how now I'm supposed to show that these acts of violence weren't just perpetrated by white Americans, but also by Blacks. I don't know what the motivation was for changing the wording of that standard, but I'm going to defer to my students and ask them to tell me what they think about that.
So Gail, what about yourself as a teacher of U.S. history? How have the last 2 years played out for you?
I'm very careful because of who I am, being a union rep and a loudmouth lesbian. It doesn't go well with a lot of people in my district. So what I do is I tell the kids, here's what's in the book. Here's what I want you to do. I want you to find something that argues against it. And if it's something that you find that I can't teach you, then maybe you want to consider being a teacher. Or maybe one of your peers in here would present your material and I let them do it. I think it's important for kids to be thinkers and not just sit there and here's the book. This is what the book says. Got it? Okay. EOC on, you know, May, whatever. It's made my kids better students. It's made my kids angry enough that they're looking at the factors that are created for them to be so-called successful. I give them the standard every day or every week or every unit, whatever the case may be, And the kids have copies of everything. I give them a copy and tell them, okay, this is what we're supposed to know. Yeehaw, let's go.
I just want to echo what Gail said, but I also, and I'm sorry to get emotional saying this, but you know, Gail, it changes the way they see you too. It changes the way they see teachers, because what we're teaching kids is how to be deep critical thinkers who are also open-minded in the process, are learning, their brains aren't fully developed yet. They're learning empathy because they can actually talk to people and disagree. And they're doing all that before they're adults. And I mean, it's hard to measure, you know, the impact that that will have on them for the rest of their lives. But, you know, if you've been teaching long enough, like Gail and I have, you go in every day knowing that. And that possibility is the thing that has made all of this so surreal. Because the idea that I would ever try to tell my students what to think, much less try to indoctrinate them. I mean, it's hard enough for me to get them to take out their materials and put their phones away every day. I mean, I don't think indoctrination would work anyway, because most of my students are just really righteous and very caring, open-minded, and the most tolerant generation of young people we've ever had. So it's always been so surreal for me to know that this is happening. What to me, this has really deeply revealed to me, at least, is just how grossly uninformed people are in general about public schools. But then again, we're here in Florida, which has been ground zero for, as I mentioned at the start, you know, two decades of standardized testing. We've been the subject of all kinds of experiments, the majority of which have not actually really addressed the fundamental challenges that we face as public school teachers.
You're listening to Florida Matters. We're talking with Gail Foreman, a high school history, social studies, and psychology teacher in Sarasota, Brant Robinson, a high school history teacher in Dunedin, and Kerry Sheridan, who covers K-12 education for WUSF. We'll talk more about how teachers are faring with Florida's education laws when we come back. Welcome back to Florida Matters. Let's get back to the conversation about how teachers are navigating Florida's education laws. We're speaking with Gail Foreman, who teaches social studies, history, and psychology at Booker High in Sarasota, and Brant Robinson, who teaches history at Dunedin High School. Also with us is WUSF's Kerry Sheridan, who covers K-12 education and has been reporting on what new education laws mean for teachers and students in the Tampa Bay region. Kerry, I wanted to come back to something you mentioned a moment ago, sort of thinking about how these laws have rolled out. Does it seem to you in your reporting and sort of what you've observed that there have been some unintended consequences to the laws that we've seen regarding education in Florida?
Oh, absolutely. I think that having to vet all the classroom library books, all the books, just see if they're in a system that just created this immense workload for teachers who are already overworked. And, you know, as we discussed, it ended up taking away a lot of books from students. And I really don't think that's what was intended. But as Gail and Brant have pointed out, I just find it amazing that, and I really think it deserves to be highlighted, how teachers have been able to navigate this, and not only just navigate it, but bring the best out of their students in the midst of it. You know, I have two middle school children myself, so I know how they feel about things. They come home and talk to me about it. They, as a parent, sometimes you can barely get the sentence out before they're telling you what they think, right? So it's really interesting to hear from the teacher's perspective as well that the students are very aware of what's happening.
Now, I wanted to just hear a little bit from some of the other teachers you've been talking with, Kerry. Let's take a listen to, again, to STEM and math middle school teacher Tracy Overdorf. And here's Tracy talking about teacher shortages.
There's a teacher shortage, and I have never felt it as much as I have felt it this year. When I did the short stint at the district school, I was replacing a teacher that left to another school. They were missing two science teachers. At the same school, they were missing an English teacher. My daughter at her high school in the district has had a long-term sub in English this entire year. And I don't know if the book ban and certain books is a reason teachers or people are not pursuing teaching English, but I know even specifically our school, which is one of, if not the top middle school in Hillsborough County, had trouble filling positions this year. You can't find teachers. And when you can't find teachers, it's also hard to find subs. And the students are suffering.
So that kind of speaks to an issue, which I guess is a little bit of a perennial issue for schools and not just in Florida. But how does that kind of illustrate, Kerry, what you're hearing from teachers and like an additional challenge that, that teachers are having to grapple with?
Yeah, I think it goes back to the workload in a sense, but, you know, not having a long-term teacher, like Brant and Gail are both veteran teachers, and students who have them are lucky that they have this stability and all this, all these years of knowledge from them. But if you have a long-term sub or even a periodic sub, it's not the same. Your educational experience isn't going to be the same as a student. So I'd be interested to hear too what the teachers are experiencing with the teacher shortage.
Mm-hmm. I would just add, I'm sorry to interrupt. I would just add that sadly, this has been normalized. In other words, I trained teachers in my district for 10 years while I was teaching high school full-time during the day. And I would always remind them that one of the most devastating statistics nationally over the last 15 years is that almost half of all teachers in this country don't make it to the end of their fifth year. So we've experienced this. It doesn't feel like there's a big teacher shortage because there kind of always has been, because the turnover is so high that it's just become normalized. So we've gotten used to having to bring in this brand new teacher who's never taught before. And suddenly, you know, she's taking over after 8 weeks. These are the things that have been happening systemically for much longer. And they're really bigger picture issues that have been going on ever since we really started to put so much of an onus on standardized tests and really taken teaching from being about the art and science of teaching to essentially covering materials so that you can measure how effective your students are learning, so that in turn you can be evaluated. And with the majority of teachers on annual contract, you know, the job is much more tenuous. So if young people are seeing all of that, and then on top of it, they're seeing the legislation, the message that a lot of young people are getting, and there's been about a 35% reduction over the last few years in the number of young people going into teaching. There have been even some departments of colleges around the country that have had to close because there's so few young people. But I think the message that a lot of young people who might have once aspired to be teachers, the message they're receiving is, I'm not respected. Like, this profession isn't respected. And that's on top of all the other challenges that I think me and Gail probably make our job look a lot easier than it really is. So,
Gail, just quickly, what about you? What's your perspective on teacher shortages? What are you seeing at your school?
As far as subs are concerned, I think the behaviors that are being tolerated because districts don't want their suspension numbers up, or they don't want too many of this race being suspended because then it looks like there's a racist issue. The subs aren't willing to come in for, I think ours pays $150 a day. They're not willing to come in and go through that for 8 periods a day. I also think we're getting people that come into education that think it's an easy job, and they get here and then, no, I'm not doing this. And then they bolt. And there, again, there's no consistency for the kids. I'm very particular as to whom I allow to sub in my room, because I'll go into work dead dog sick if I'm going to have to put up with a crappy sub. And I don't want my kids to miss a full day of instruction. I think the problem with subbing now is DeSantis has opened us up to all kinds of issues with secondary performance. I mean, they've retired. They think they're going to come in and be, you know, a buddy-buddy with the kids. And they don't know the content. They don't understand the pedagogy involved in that teaching lesson.
And just to clarify, Gail, you're referring to kind of new regulations about the kinds of subs that are now allowed in schools. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, well, both. I mean, we're not getting quality subs, and we're not getting quality teachers because he's lowered the standards. And that is, in my opinion, I mean, you can't take a police officer and say he has a bachelor's in criminal justice or political science and stick him in a classroom to teach history or English or reading or even math. He might be able to do some of the basics, but when it comes to knowing the depth and knowing how to get your kids to think and challenging them without getting behavior issues, you just don't come in off the street with those skills.
I did want to just play one more piece of sound if we could. And this is Steve Conover. And Kerry, this is another teacher you've spent quite a bit of time over the past couple of years talking to about changes that he's seen in the classroom. He's a middle school math teacher in Hillsborough County. And here's Steve Conover's take on the flurry of new laws.
When it comes to education law, the people who are making all these laws, all I ask is, Have them substitute teach for a week, just a week, in a whole year. Pick one. And then they truly will be able to see what a day-to-day operation is for any school. And I think that would give them a better understanding, because a lot of people feel like there is a disconnect between the lawmakers and the ones who are actually in education.
Kerry, how does that kind of fit in with what you're hearing from other teachers? I guess what we're hearing today from Brant and Gail.
Yeah, absolutely. Steve Conover said it very well there, I think. And other teachers I've spoken to said the same thing when I asked them, what kind of legislation would you like to see, say, next year? If you were a lawmaker, what kinds of laws would you make about education? And they say, just leave me alone. Let me do my job. Stop making all these laws that make everything harder, you know? And having someone who's spent time in a classroom then move over to the legislative side, that would be wonderful.
Mm. Well, as we wrap up here, I want to ask all of you kind of how you're going to be watching things play out from the classroom and from a reporting perspective. Gail, what are you going to be paying attention to as the school year wraps up and you start thinking about the new school year?
Interpretations. I'm concerned that if let's have a universal policy in every school. So with these new standards, I think there's too much deviation in our districts. And if we somehow got all of our districts together and parents truly understood what was going on and what has happened in the last 2 years, I think we might be able to change things instead of the politicians.
Brant, how about you? What's on your mind?
Really, to echo Gail's last sentiment, I'm thinking more the big picture, specifically with school board races, not just school board races in Pinellas County, but across the state and across the country. You know, it's very promising is how poorly the results have been for the Moms for Liberty candidates over the last 6 months. And I think that's because, efforts of people like us. I just spoke at the school board meeting last night. There are people doing that now across the country. And in the process, we're educating more of the public about what's really happening. And so I'm very interested and I'm very engaged in the process of making sure, for example, that in my county, and Gail understands this because it's happened in Sarasota County, but, by Moms for Liberty's own playbook, if they gain a majority on the school board, the very first thing they do, and they've done this in I think 5 or 6 counties in Florida already, they will fire the superintendent. We have 2 Moms for Liberty members on our board. There are 3 open seats for the August race, and all of them are candidates backed by Moms for Liberty who are in the race as well. And like I said, should they gain a majority, the consequences could be devastating. So for me, I'm reaching out to more of our public, which is why I'm so grateful to be here with you, in hopes that, as more of our fellow citizens are listening, they understand that, this isn't a Democrat, Republican, independent thing. This is about public schools. And if you really believe that they are the foundation of our democracy, then you have to not only be concerned, but you have to be concerned enough to be engaged.
Kerry, what are you going to be paying attention to in your reporting on education in the weeks and months ahead?
Well, these were great points brought up. School board races, the political involvement, having, nonpartisan school boards not really being a thing anymore. I'm also interested in the rise in testing that's come about with the FAST testing. It's actually 3 tests a year instead of 1. And broadly, the way I'm interested in the way that students are coming out of this, the students who are graduating high school. What are they going to do going forward in the years ahead?
We've been speaking with WUSF's Kerry Sheridan, who covers K-12 education. Kerry, thank you so much for your time and your reporting.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Brant Robinson, who teaches history at Dunedin High School. Brant, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. It's my pleasure.
And Gail Foreman, who teaches social studies, history, and psychology at Booker High in Sarasota. Gail, thank you so much.
My pleasure as well. Thank you.
That's our show for this week. Our executive producer is Grayson Doctor. Subscribe to Florida Matters wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.